Welcome to Cold Steel, the Canadian Journal of Surgery podcast, with your hosts Amir Farouk and Chad Ball. The goal of the CJS podcast is threefold. The first is to highlight the best research currently being completed by Canadian surgeons. The second is to offer educational topics for both surgeons and trainees alike. And most importantly, the third goal is to inspire discussion, thoughts, creativity, and career development in all Canadian surgeons. We hope you enjoy it.
Today, we interview Dr. Boutros, a leader in colorectal surgery and a well-published researcher on so many topics in the field of colorectal surgery. Today's episode focuses on low anterior resection syndrome, otherwise known as LARS. We discussed many important facets, including the pathophysiology of LARS, intraoperative techniques to mitigate the impact of LARS on patients, the management of LARS postoperatively, and finally, research surrounding patient-reported outcomes.
Dr. Boutros, it's an absolute pleasure and an honor to finally have you on the Cold Steel podcast. You're obviously a Canadian surgical icon for colorectal surgery, and although we're sad to have lost you to the U.S. and to Cleveland Clinic, we're obviously very proud of you and just delighted to have you on the show. So thank you again for joining us.
Thank you so much, Dr. Farouk. It's really an honor. And when I watch the previous people on the podcast, and I feel like an imposter here, but thank you very much for having me. And I look forward to a fun chat.
Absolutely. So can you tell us a little bit about where you grew up and where you did your training?
Yeah, absolutely. I was born at a McGill hospital. I was born at St. Mary's in Montreal. And I did all my training at McGill. I did an undergrad, and then I did medicine at McGill. I did general surgery at McGill. And then I came to Cleveland Clinic, Florida for my fellowship. I stayed for 2 years to complete Canadian requirements for colorectal certification. And then I came back to practice in 2012 at the Jewish General Hospital, a McGill-affiliated hospital. And I stayed there for 11 years. Never thought I would move in my wildest dream. Didn't have my USMLEs, nothing. I was pretty dead set on, you know, serving Canada and being in Canada. Then a nice opportunity arose and I just moved back to Cleveland Clinic, Florida. Have not left Canada and still heavily love Canada and want to remain involved in Canada.
Congratulations. That's such an amazing trajectory and pathway. You know, I think it's worth highlighting your fellowship at Cleveland Clinic, Florida, because from what I hear from other folks who have gone to train there, it's a bit of a unique experience. Can you tell us a little bit about how your fellowship was structured at Cleveland Clinic?
Sure. It's mentorship based, which I think is really nice for colorectal surgery because we do a lot more than just operate. And as trainees, all we want to do is go to the operating room and operate. So if you leave it up to trainees, most often I found from my colleagues who were training at other sites, is you go to the operating room most of the year. And then towards the end of the year, you're like, oh, maybe I should figure out some clinic or do some endoscopy. What about transanal ultrasound? And so the way it's structured here, and that's the way we structured our program at McGill as well, is whatever your mentor is doing for the month, you're doing it too. Unless your mentor is away, then you have academic time or you join another team because often there's more than one operating room running. And so in a model like Cleveland Clinic, that amounts to going to the operating room 2 to 3 times a week, doing endoscopy for half day or full day a week and doing at least a day of clinic a week. That way you really make sure you're covering the breadth of colorectal surgery as you go throughout the fellowship, and you rotated with each attending twice. So first time it's a little colder, you don't know each other well. And then the second time, you know them really well. And then most people do 1 year. But Canadians, a lot of us do 2 years. And so and some Americans do 2 years. The second year is kind of like junior faculty, where you run Dr. Wexner's practice, essentially. And he has 2 to 3 rooms at times. And so you run the second room and you have a trainee with you, either a fellowship council trainee or a ACGME trainee. And so you get an opportunity to, you know, try out your junior staff skills before I came home to McGill, which was really nice. So it made for an easy transition where I had no issues working, you know, with residents and giving up parts of the case and teaching them. And I was just fortunate. It worked out that Dr. Wexner was in his ASCRS presidential year when I was here. So it meant doing a lot of stuff with him, helping him prepare his presidential address and helping him with a lot of the ASCRS endeavors. And so I got to know a lot of people and just figure out how he thinks and works. And so it's a cool second year. Busy.
Yeah, it's a really like a neat sort of mentorship sort of model where you really get to work with someone and see what goes into their life, not just in the operating room, which is sometimes how what we you know what we all gravitate towards, but it's not the total of someone's life. And particularly like, you know, someone like Wexner, his career has been a lot about what he's done outside the op. That's a really cool model, hey?
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit, you know, about your practice now at Cleveland Clinic. What is sort of your setup like, and what's it like to work down at Cleveland Clinic after having been in at McGill for many years?
Yeah, well, what I have to say really, what I'm most struck with is we do really good medicine in Canada. And I think we should all be extremely proud, and I will always be extremely proud. I think that's the high standard to look up to. We offer really good evidence-based practice to our patients. We're a lot less swayed than what's happening in the American culture in terms of surgery. And I think we should be exceptionally proud that we're doing what's new, what's great, and what's evidence-based for our patients. The other stark difference is that we are so resource-stricken, and that's the heaviest load that we carry. And I think we need to acknowledge that. And we do really great for our patients in the system that we have. And why I like the Cleveland Clinic and why I would have even ventured to come down south is that it's a very value-based model and not productivity-based model. It's all about value here and very evidence-based practice. Unfortunately, what I see referred in is a lot of the Wild West being done at neighboring institutions and across the country. And so I think it's a scary, different field. I have to say here at Cleveland Clinic, really, it's because it's value-based, so I feel comfortable. I feel like I'm in Canada with a bit more resources to do the things that we would have liked to do for our patients. So operate in a timely manner and, you know, get them to see all the consultants in one day rather than come back and forth to the hospital, things like that. You know, we had 3 ostomy nurses here. We have 6, things like that, that make a difference and make it a little lighter. But yeah, the quality and the value is the focus here. But outside of this little bubble, I'm seeing all sorts of things being referred in, unfortunately. So my practice here is very similar to Montreal. That's what I asked for in coming back. And so I operate once a week. I'm in clinic once a week, and I'm in endoscopy half a day a week. And the remainder of the time, I'm focusing on research for the Digestive Disease Institute here. And my main project is really getting us to use patient-reported outcome measures in clinical practice. And it's nice because they have the infrastructure to do so. So that's kind of my pet project that I'm working on now, along with my research goals.
That is so cool. And I like how you very politely and gently stated that the issue about resources really is quite a stark difference sometimes when you see what the American institutions can provide for their patients. And you're absolutely right. Like what we can do here in Canada when we're kind of strapped sometimes. It's really not fair, right?
Yeah. And I think it takes a toll on us. Like it makes us tired. And I want to say it in a positive light, like just pat ourselves on the shoulder that we're doing such a good job despite the limitations we have. At the end, we're doing really good care. And we just need to take care of ourselves, because I think the hardest thing that weighs on us in Canada is how am I going to get this done? It's not what should I do. We all know what to do. Lots of really amazing surgeons. We're pushing the limit of everything that's new and evidence-based. It's just, how do I get it done? How do I get the time? You know, how do I fit this patient in? And it really weighs on us. And just acknowledging that and knowing that that takes a big toll on us and taking care of ourselves, I think is super important, and each other.
I couldn't agree more. Well, listen, there's like a million things we could talk to you about from a research perspective. I mean, you really, the breadth and depth of colorectal surgery you've plumbed, right? You know, whether it's diverticulitis, we could go on for days talking about all the different things that you looked at. But I think one of the things that I think affects a lot of patients, whether you're in colorectal surgery or general surgery, is low anterior resection syndrome. You really, this has become an area that you've really done the seminal research in now. And so we wanted to talk to you a little bit about low anterior resection syndrome. So for anyone who doesn't know what this clinical syndrome is, can you tell us a little bit about what low anterior resection syndrome is?
Sure. Thank you, Amir. When we remove the rectum or even the rectal sigmoid, we anastomose the colon to the residual rectum, and patients are really happy that they don't have a permanent bag. Unfortunately, the rectum's a great reservoir, and when you do without it, patient's bowel function is quite disturbed. So low anterior resection syndrome really became popular only 10 years ago when our Danish colleagues developed a score to measure it. But essentially the five elements of the score that they created are incontinence to gas, incontinence to solid stool, clustering of bowel movements, as well as urgency and frequency. And the clustering of the bowel movements seems to be one of the most problematic ones because the patients don't have that nice reservoir anymore, as well as the neural feedback that they had before. And so patients will go to the bathroom, have a small bowel movement come out, go to the bathroom, have a small bowel movement come out. And many patients are toilet bound for an evening, for a morning, or it could be unpredictable, but this can go on for several hours. And so that's, patients don't know how to describe it often. They'll come reporting that they have diarrhea or that they have a complication of their surgery, but it's this constellation of symptoms. Other symptoms that are not captured in the current LAR score are difficult evacuation. So some patients will sit on the toilet and nothing will come out, and they'll have trouble evacuating. All this disordered bowel function after a restorative proctectomy is really encapsulated in LARS. Bill Heald described it. He noticed in the 1990s, you know, he taught total mesorectal excision. You got to take out the entire rectum with its package all the way to the pelvic floor. But then he noticed that if you anastomose really low, as he had initially described, functions really bad. And if you just save 3 to 5 centimeters of the distal rectum, patient's function was significantly better. So he described that in the 1990s. And I found a review paper in 2000 where people started talking about LARS, but it really took on its shape and form in 2012 only. So it's a newer concept, but definitely something our patients have been experiencing for decades.
What kind of got you interested in the topic?
The patients. So, you know, coming out of fellowship, you're like super excited when you get a rectal cancer. It's a challenge. And then if you can do it minimally invasively with good oncologic results, you're like really happy and you feel like you've done so well. So then you see them in clinic, and you know, these bigger guys who have tight pelvises, and you've got that coloanal, and then when you reverse them, they come back and they're miserable. And you're like, but wait, you're cancer-free. You got that anastomosis that I worked so hard from. I had one patient who asked me if he could have a stoma, like in his first post-op visit, to kind of the stoma back. I was like, oh my God, we are not doing them a service. And they would show up on my list, my clinic list, and their complaint that the intake would take was diarrhea, complication of surgery. And I was like, what complication? You did fine. And then I realized it was a problem, and I was spending a lot of time in clinic talking about LARS. And then one of our nurse people, like our clinical oncology nurse, she said to me, hey, Mary Lees, what do you think if we do the LARS score? I saw this LARS score. What do you say we do it with our patients in clinic? And I said, yeah, that's great. Let's do it. And let's make sure that it gets into the chart so that if the patient, you do it with the patient, then I can see the score. And it sort of started organically like that. It was her idea. And since then, I felt like this is something that we as clinicians in survivorship visits were really busy. I don't know about you guys, but they're probably scheduled 15-minute visits where you just put up the flex, check on them. And I don't have that much time to talk about LARS. And even though we talk to them about it pre-op, there's information overload for our you know, poor patients at the beginning, especially with all the different rectal cancer treatment strategies. And so I felt like we've got to do our patients better. And so that's how I started to be interested in what's going on with LARS.
Yeah, I mean, that's such a fascinating story. And it's inspiring in that you looked at something that our patients deal with all the time, and took that and really ran with it. And I think it is interesting that, like, how long we've been doing rectal cancer surgery in the modern form, and yet we really don't have a lot of good strategies ways to predict. And, you know, like there's a lot of work that needs to be done in this area. You know, Carl Brown always would always tell patients after we reverse the ileostomy, like, look, you're going to hate me for the first month. And then it gets better. But anyways, well, I want to talk to you a little bit more about that time aspect as well, too. But can you tell us a little bit about, you know, in the work that you've done, how do you understand the pathophysiology of LARS, and how does it seem to develop?
Well, you're right. We don't know much. I was just with Charlie Knowles in England, who is really working on pathophysiology. So I'm echoing what other people have done. But first and foremost, you remove the rectum. It's a beautiful reservoir, and you don't know it till you lose it. So that's a big part of it. Even if you do a sigmoid resection for our general surgery colleagues and you remove the sigmoid, you leave the rectum completely intact. What Charlie showed is that at the rectosigmoid, there's some back pressure. It is a true valve, if you want to say, and there's some back pressure that holds the stool out of the rectum. He was telling me, like, Mary Lee's stool doesn't sit in your rectum all day. It actually, when it sits in your rectum, you know it's there, and then you go to the bathroom. So I didn't appreciate that till our last conversation where he was showing me some of his work. But there's this valve at the rectosigmoid with back pressure. And when you do a sigmoid resection, say for diverticulitis, and you anastomose to the upper rectum, you remove that valve. And so our patients, even after an anterior resection or sigmoid resection, also have disturbed bowel function, much less so because they still have the nice rectal reservoir. So rectal reservoir that you lose, loss of that rectal sigmoid angle with back pressure, keeping the stool in the colon. And then when we mobilize the left colon and bring it down to create the anastomosis, we create autonomic denervation, which actually causes increased colonic motility. And so there's the clustering feature. Then you add some pelvic radiation and some fibrosis. You definitely affect the nerves there. Add some staplers or Hansel and Coloanal. You are, you know, meddling with the resting anal pressure. And there you go. You have sort of the constellation of what we experience as LARS. A big part is that rectum is so beautiful. It has a very large capacity to expand, and you lose that with our resections.
How much of it is related to dissection along the hypogastric nerves? Because I think that's something that, like, you know, gets ingrained into you when you're doing these operations, that you have to protect those nerves. So how much of that actually plays into this?
Yeah, they're studying that in humans right now, but in animal models, it's what's causing the increased colonic motility. And so we're not sure yet in the humans what the impact is. Dr. Knowles and others are looking into that. But yes, for sure, there's some dysregulation based on the nerves that get at least a paresis, if not paralysis, with our surgery.
Yeah, and you mentioned the bit about radiation. Are there certain other risk factors that are really prominent to you? I think we talked a little bit about the height of the anastomosis. That clearly intuitively makes some sense. But are there some other risk factors that you've identified from your research that really make people prone to having LARS?
Yeah, there's a few interesting ones. The duration of diversion, and you know that in our system, patients remain with their temporary ileostomy for longer than they need to clinically, just because of wait lists. So on average, they wait at least a year in our cohort. And we found, as well as colleagues in the UK found, that the duration of diversion impacts the degree of LARS after you close the ileostomy. And so that's a factor. So if we can close our patients earlier, that would help. And that's just a systems issue. One that came up in a cohort study that Richard Garfinkel did, and then we looked at it in the literature, and it's time and time again shown, is that actually younger patients report higher LARS. And you would think that older patients have weaker pelvic floors, weaker muscles, and they would have higher LARS. And we know from the general population, Jenny Moon did this, we looked at the LARS score in just the general population and found that the older you are, and women more than men, have major LARS. And a good 15% of the older population have major LARS without having any colorectal surgery. So it's not a very specific instrument. But back to the women, back to the younger people, I think the younger people have to get back to work. They have so much work to do. They have kids to take care of or roles in their lives, and they have a higher expectation of what their function is supposed to be like. And I think they're probably more critical of their function. That's the way I can best understand it. But that's a repeated finding in many different cohort studies, that younger age have higher LARS. And so that's even another reason why I want to keep pushing this field forward, is that, you know, we're seeing rectal cancer in younger and younger people. We're getting really good at curing rectal cancer, thankfully, and they're living longer and longer. So we have this huge cohort of rectal cancer survivors who need to go back to work. They need to function. They need to fulfill their roles, and they're not able to. And so so younger age, and then female sex was also found in multiple studies. And I think the sphincter is generally weaker in women. That could probably be an attributing factor. And then we also have all the insults from birthing and delivery that affect the pelvic floor. So yeah, those are some of the other ones. Oh, and anastomotic leak. And that also makes sense, because it probably makes the whole pelvis fibrotic.
Right. Yeah, that the piece about the younger patients is super interesting. So when you're seeing patients in clinic, what are the, you mentioned the actual LARS score. So just remind us again about what the components are for that. And what are, like, how do you sort of suss that out and try to categorize how significant their LARS is when you're practically seeing someone in clinic?
Yeah. So it's a 5-item questionnaire, and it was created by surveying patients and with patient input in Denmark. And it's anchored to a simple question when they created the score. It was anchored to a question: how much does your bowel function impact your quality of life? A lot, a little bit, or none. And when they anchored it to that question, they created three categories: major LARS, which is a score of 30 on 42 or greater, minor LARS, and no LARS. And so in clinic, what ideally these patient reported outcome measures, the patient should do it without the clinician, but, you know, we hand it to them. Our nurse used to hand them a piece of paper. They just score their LARS when they walk into the clinic to see us. They'll come in with their sheet. So that, number one, opens the conversation so that it's not left out of the survivorship visit. And rather than trying to understand from them exactly what's going on, because it's very qualitative and colorful sometimes and hard to articulate, you have a score that kind of tells you what's bothering them the most. And then I try to figure out, is it bothering them in the morning? Is it bothering them in the evening? You know, and what's it impeding them to do? So a major problem with the LARS score in its current form is we don't know if it's really bothering them at all. Like, if they're working from home, then they're fine. You know, they can go to the bathroom in and out. Whereas somebody who can't return to work or has a very physical job, then the LARS score might look the same in both those people. But so you need to tease out from them, how is this affecting you? And we're currently working in an international collaboration to create a new LARS score, which really combines a wider array of symptoms, so 8 symptoms rather than 5, with consequence or bother. Because if the patient is experiencing a symptom and has a high LARS score, but it's not bothering them, well, there's no sense spending any time or teaching them any self-help technique. Whereas they might have a minor LARS score, but they can't get their kids to school or can't get to work, and it's impacting them a lot. So the LARS score is an evolution. The first LARS score is great at screening patients. Do they have LARS? Yes, no. But it doesn't really tell you if their symptoms are getting better. It's not very sensitive to change. And it doesn't tell you if it's bothering them or not. So long answer. But in clinic, I think it's good, very good to screen for LARS, because patients will often not want to bring it up. Like, they'll be like, oh, Dr. Farouk is very busy. He's a surgeon. I'm not sure I should be bringing this up with him. And so unless you ask, they might not bring it up. So having the LARS score being administered, just a piece of paper while they're registering, or, you know, a part of your electronic chart, and then it comes to you, then you know how much of your discussion you can address this issue with them. But then in my studies, I was observing that the LARS score doesn't change. I powered most of my studies to quality of life. And thankfully so, because the LARS score doesn't change much over time, despite patients feeling better, because it's not that bother or that consequence. Nonetheless, I think it's an amazing clinical tool to identify LARS, open the discussion about LARS, and teach patients about how to manage their LARS.
That's interesting what you just said about their LAR score not actually improving very much over time, because, you know, anecdotally, it seems that patients get better. But I think what I'm hearing you say is that it's not that so much that they're getting better, it's more so that they've perhaps adapted to what their function is going to be like. So it seems like a much more complicated situation than simply just saying, like, this is how many times I have bowel movements, or this is how often I have diarrhea, or whatever the case may be. It's a very complex set of interactions between their physiologic function and their activities in their life. Is that fair?
That's better said than I've ever said it, but it is true. Exactly so.
So do we see any improvement over time, or is that just something that that the people adapt to having bars?
From the Danish work and from European work, and we're looking to hopefully have our own Canadian data soon, is that about 60% of people will have major LARS after proctectomy or after reversal of their ileostomy. And it probably gets better to 50% at 1 year. So 10% get significantly better to drop out of that major LARS category. I think what really does happen is patients adapt, like you're saying, and they learn some self-management strategies, whatever they be. You know, most patients come to our clinics and they don't eat before they come. Okay, they come with their little bag of extra change of clothes and they actually don't eat. And we tell them, you guys can eat. They're like, no, we can't. You know, we won't know where the bathroom is. So I think in our new LAR score, we hopefully want to see an improvement because they're adapting, despite that the number of bowel movements or the number of accidents may not be that improving that much. For longer term data, there was a nice one that said 75% of people stay exactly in the same category of LARS. 10% get worse over 10 years and 15% get better. So yes, 10 to 15% do get better. And when I read qualitative studies, I see a lot of remarks from patients that say, we surgeons told them, give it a year, it'll get better. Give it a few weeks, it'll get better. For sure, I think the first 3 months are rock and roll. Like, patients are up at night. They feel like the world is going to end. So something does get a little bit better that we're not capturing granularly very well. And I think the first year is the toughest year. And so physiologically, they do improve a little bit. And then to a large part, they adapt.
Yeah. I mean, one thing just before we go on that I forgot to ask you is, what is the incidence of LARS? Like, let's say if you just specifically talk about rectal cancer, how often do patients get LARS, and how does that change when they've had radiation? Obviously, this is a complicated, nuanced sort of question nowadays, especially with rectal cancer being the way it is. But can you give us a sense of how often do people get LARS if you look at all comers for rectal cancer?
Yeah, it depends obviously when you ask them, but initially, in the first year, 60% have major LARS and 70% have any LARS. And by the end of the first year, 50% have some degree of LARS.
These are not huge numbers, right? You know, you're talking about, we've talked a lot about the score, the LARS score, and how you're developing a new score. And obviously a passion for you seems to be patient-reported outcomes and that type of research. Can you talk to us a little bit about, so first of all, there's a lot of different terms that get thrown around, patient-reported outcomes. There's a few other terms that aren't even coming to my brain at this moment. Can you talk to us a little bit about what it means to look at patient-reported outcomes? How do you actually go about studying a complex topic like this, where, you know, there's all these interplay of different factors that are going on?
Yeah, are attributing to it. So we as physicians can recognize that it's a problem, but I think if we're going to bring this field forward, we need to ask the patient. And there's the two main ways that I find have been helpful to bring the field forward are to use patient-reported outcomes in our research and to use qualitative methodology, neither of which I was well-trained in before. So for qualitative methodology, it's like really grown on me. I thought it was a bit hocus-pocus, when I was a trainee. And it's great because a lot of, I think, the ideas I get for the next study come from qualitative work that either I've done or that I've read that someone else has done. But that's where you really can delve into the issue deeper with patients and understand the impact on them, understand the interplay, as we said, between their adaptive strategies and the symptoms that they're having. And so before each study almost launches, I have a qualitative component where I really delve deeper in a focus group or in one-on-one interviews with patients, likewise with, you know, physicians and nurse practitioners to understand some of the issues and barriers of whatever I'm planning to implement. And I've found that to be super helpful, is just talking to the patients in a methodical way and getting their opinion and understanding their lived experience. I think it's quite enlightening. And I can share some papers with you that I think are remarkable for that, so we can share with our group. And then the other thing is patient-reported outcome measures. I've learned on the go about these. I think they need to be robust instruments that really respond to change, especially if we want to see a change. So unfortunately, the LAR score we talked about, its pitfall, but there are some great generic scores and other disease-specific scores out there that are extremely well-developed, that are robust, and that change with treatment or intervention, so we can see some hope and some light and move forward. And these really should be done by the patient, so they can't be too onerous. There's some great PROMs out there. You think they cover everything you want, but they're going to take half an hour to do. Patients just aren't going to do them. I think, like, you know, the Wexner score, the LAR score, their claims to fame is that they're simple and easy to administer and they're light on the heart, so patients will do them. And we need the infrastructure and the personnel to do them, right? So patients are waiting in the waiting room most of the time for a while, at least if they're coming to Boutros Clinic. So, like, there's an opportunity there, but you need an iPad, you need a database that these PROMs are going to go into, you need an ethics so that you can study the results of these and then bring the field forward. Yeah, so I think put a lot of thought into picking one or two PROMs that you want to do in whatever you're interested in improving in your clinical work. And it's hard work up front, but then if you can just do it for a year or two, you'll get really good data and you'll start understanding better the impact of what you're doing on your patients, whatever the surgery is that you're doing. Like, how do you know that you're actually doing them well? You mean well, but I don't know that we're actually doing them well. And for Lars, for example, doesn't mean we're going to stop doing rectal cancer surgery, probably not going to change what we do. But I believe strongly from the results that I've seen that we need a Lars nurse, kind of like the ostomy nurse. You need a Lars nurse or continence nurse, something that's, you know, a person that has the time that is going to phone these patients on week one when they think their world has ended, and help them through so that we can get the good result that we intended with all our hard work. When you think about it, a Lars nurse is not a huge investment next to how many people we can actually help and bring back to the workforce and get the result we wanted. So I think PROMs will show us how well we're doing in the service we're trying to provide.
Yeah, I think that's so well said. Do you actually have a Lars nurse now at Cleveland Clinic, or is that something you're working on?
I'm working on it. We do at McGill because we, Richard and I ran, we called it Lars RCT, that many of our colleagues in Canada participated in. And it was an intervention where at the time of ostomy closure, we enrolled them multi-center randomized to either a Lars nurse and an educational booklet so that they know the term Lars, they know what's happening to their bodies. And we tried to do preoperative education. And then we walk the walk with them for the first year, and we're just closing that trial out now. And so we'll definitely share the booklet so as a PDF so everybody can use it in their clinics. And so the nurse who was engaged, she was an endoscopy nurse, a senior endoscopy nurse, and she's just awesome. She learned Lars management and she did this, and then she doesn't want to stop doing it. So she takes care of all our patients now and is effectively the Lars nurse at the Jewish General Hospital. And I've recruited someone here and I'm in the process of teaching her and setting things up here. But I think any engaged nurse who, you know, really wants to listen to the patient and walk the walk. In the study, I said her role is really a sounding board. She's not there to prescribe anything, but she's there to help and educate on all the self-management strategies for Lars, so patients don't feel abandoned and on their own when they're having the toughest time. They feel like, oh, small operation and I'm going to go back to normal. And then they're hit with this very different new normal.
Yeah, it's almost like this whammy where they're like, oh, finally I got rid of my loop-ileostomy. And I'm like, oh God, what just happened to me? I think that segues really nicely into talking about the management of LARS. And I mean, again, anecdotally, you see people manage this in all sorts of different ways. What are some of the strategies that have been borne out from the work that you've done that actually do seem to help treat patients with LARS? And how do you think about that when you're seeing someone who you think has LARS?
Treatment of LARS is a step-up approach. And again, our colleagues in Denmark and Europe published excellent guidelines on the management of LARS, and I think they encapsulate the treatment pretty well. And I'll share that with you. So it's an upside-down pyramid. And the main trunk is managing expectations and preparing patients for what's coming up. And so preoperative education, whether it's ourselves, for sure, we all mention LARS and dysfunction in our consent discussion, but I feel that that's far gone by the time their ileostomy is closed. And so I feel that at the time of ileostomy closure is really the best time to educate patients and engage them so that they're empowered for the next part of the strategy, which is self-management strategies. And so things like Metamucil or other bulking agents, managing how much they drink and when they drink, managing high fiber foods. Most patients find that if they avoid salads and other roughage, their bowel movements will be easier to control and more predictable. And so avoiding certain diet patterns that patients find aggravating, as well as like sugary drinks and things like that, aggravate their symptoms often. And then learning Imodium, Lamotil, different strategies with antidiarrheals, cholestyramine. So patients can, you know, experiment with antidiarrheals. And the thing is, like, the patient has to do it. We can't prescribe, oh, here, take one Imodium a day and you'll be better. Because if they're having LARS symptoms all night, well, maybe they should take an Imodium before they go to bed. If the problem is the morning, then maybe they should take an Imodium with breakfast, you know? So they need to be in tune with what's going on, because we're not with them day in and day out is what I tell them. So they can know how to manage these self-management strategies. Anal skincare, for sure. And, you know, moderating their activities in a different way to accommodate for their symptoms. So that's kind of like the first line in the management. Cool things that are like coming up is Zofran and other serotonin antagonists. A Korean trial showed that a serotonin antagonist, ramucirumab, really decreased early LARS in the first month from like 80% to, I believe, 50-something%. Good improvement, one pill a day, kind of like, you know, dropping the rate of LARS. And then in Switzerland, they looked at Zofran. And, you know, we use Zofran often. What if you gave patients Zofran once a day for the first month? Maybe it could make things a little better during that rock and roll period. And so they had some promising early results. So that's something on medication that's out there. And then the next adjuncts that we can offer our patients is biofeedback or pelvic floor rehabilitation. And I don't know what it's like in Ontario, but in Quebec, it's hard for patients to get a pelvic physiotherapist, unfortunately, and it's all privately paid. It helps. Basically, the summary for pelvic floor rehab is, and for those who aren't highly colorectal people, it's really muscle retraining of the pelvic floor. And so our physiotherapists who are trained in the pelvic floor can use electrodes and balloons in the anus to really teach patients to re-engage their muscles down there. It helps while they're doing it is what the data shows, maybe for a couple months after, and then it drops off again. So it's not the be all or end all, but for patients who are motivated and have the means, it's something that is they can try. And I've done it for some patients who want to try even at the time where their ileostomy is in place. So they get the process going. So when their ileostomy is closed, you know, things are already in motion. The thing that I'm really fired up about and I find has dramatically changed people's quality of life is transanal irrigation. We have a crossover trial on that right now. And again, the Danish have been using it for a lot longer and it just hasn't, you know, made way in North America. But basically patients can take a soft catheter. This is a commercial catheter. Patients can stick a soft catheter in the anus. There's a balloon that they inflate that occludes the anus, and then a pump to fill a liter of tap water in a bag then it releases and it irrigates out the whole colon once they open the balloon and they can expel it. It's a process that takes about 20 minutes for most patients, and then they won't have a bowel movement for 2 to 3 days. So they do this and they can forget about their bowel movements and do it routinely. We ask patients to do it once a day until they fall into a pattern. Then they can drop down to every 2 days, every 3 days. So for patients who are having major LARS and are quite symptomatic, can't get back to work, this has changed their lives. They've been able to get back to work and they've been able to get back to their routines because it takes away all the unpredictability and being tied to a toilet that LARS does to a lot of people. And a major problem with our crossover trial, this is something that Jessica Holland and I were working on when she was at McGill, is people don't want to cross over. They beg us not to cross over. We tell them, please just cross over for 3 months so we can show, you know, that this is helpful indeed. And then you can go back to your transanal irrigation. So I think that's something we can offer our patients probably earlier on, not wait for 2 years of suffering if they're really having, you know, an impact on their able to function and their quality of life. Another thing that we can offer our patients is sacral neuromodulation. Again, hard to come by in Canada, but it definitely can point people to who can help out. Our urologists are helping out, and Dr. McFadden at University of Sherbrooke is helping out. And I'm very hopeful that we'll have a few sacral neuromodulation champions in Quebec and Ontario soon. And so sacral neuromodulation has been awesome for fecal incontinence. It's, you know, been proven to improve fecal incontinence, drop it by half essentially, and be durable for over 10 years. And so people have tried it in LARS and it works. It works in LARS. Just, I find it works for the fecal incontinence component of LARS more than the clustering component, is my anecdotal experience.
That's an amazing overview. And can I just pick out a few things, just being purely selfish when I have patients, although none of my patients have LARS, just so we're clear. So specifically about the Metamucil, is that problem? It sounds like it almost like that it's problematic to have fiber for patients who potentially have LARS, or did I misunderstand that?
Digestible fiber seems to be problematic, whereas undigestible fiber like Metamucil is less problematic. It absorbs the water and clumps the bowel movements together. So yeah, they're two different types of fiber, essentially, is what I learned in figuring out the stuff with patients. And so it remains undigested. And so it seems to help with clumping the bowel movements together and absorbing water, whereas salad and other roughage is problematic.
Okay. And it sounds like for the Imodium, that's really something patients have. And this is what I typically tell patients as well, too, that it's something that you have to sort of titrate or play around with to see if that helps.
Yes. And it works for some patients like a charm. And in other patients, it backs them up for 2-3 days. And then they get this aftermath of Imodium that is terrible, almost worse than the symptoms themselves. Mm. And so it's not worth the effort. A lot of patients will use it if they're coming to the doctor, going on the airplane, going to a wedding. And so if they can figure it out and titrate it, as you said, then it works well for some. Definitely is not like the one pill that's going to fix the problem for most.
Totally. And cholestyramine, that's not something that I have been typically, you know, I almost thought of it more of the patient who had refractory diarrhea after right colectomy and losing their TI. But where does cholestyramine fit into the picture for LARS, and how do you use it?
Yeah, same. I mean, I try Metamucil, Benefiber. If that doesn't work, and Imodium, it constipates them too much or gives them cramps because some patients don't really like the experience of the antidiarrheals, then cholestyramine is just something else in our armamentarium that hopefully can cause still some bile acid absorption despite, you know, having their TI and cecum, but causing some bile acid absorption and hopefully helping, you know, bulk their bowel movements. It works for some. It also doesn't taste great, so a lot of patients don't like it.
And, you know, in the absence of what sounds like really cool innovation with the transanal irrigation, and I've talked to Jessica Holland about that work that she's done too, and it sounds super cool. Do you find that ever just having patients give themselves enemas or things like that, is that also helpful for patients who have LARS, or does not really make a difference in the absence of what sounds like sort of like colonic irrigation?
Mm-hmm. What got me interested in it is I was recommending an enema, and I think it works. It works less so. It's not as good, But patients know how to take an enema because they do it before coming for their flex sig. And so, especially when things are terrible in the first few months, I would tell them to take an enema before going to bed, just to hopefully give them 3 or 4 hours of sleeping before the clustering happens again. And so it's kind of like a baby step up to transanal irrigation, and definitely good advice. It doesn't work as well because they still have their colon full of stool, but I was using it far before. I even had taught patients tap water enema, you know, anything to get rid of stool in the left colon. Give them a few hours break for sure. You can ask them, like, when you come for your flex sig in clinic, are you okay that day? And if the answer is yes, then like, okay, well, so why don't you, you can do that more often then, you know, if it's helping them, that's a good measure if it's working or not. And then I tell them to empty out the fleet, like just use the water, like tap water in the fleet bottle. They don't need fleet every time.
One thing we didn't talk about is actually any intraoperative techniques. Like, you know, a lot of things we can't modify, whether they need radiation, how low you have to go, that's not within our control. Are there any operative techniques that seem to benefit and help people with postoperative LARS?
Yeah, I can't believe I forgot to mention that. That's great. So the only thing kind of in our control is if we can do a reconstruction. And so here in fellowship, I had learned the colonic J pouch, which really necessitates mobilization of the splenic flexure every time, and a redundant enough colon that you can form a full colonic J pouch, which is an 8-centimeter limb. And so I sort of backed away from that because it's extensive. And I really love the Baker anastomosis, which I had learned in residency training, aside to end. I feel like just as an anastomosis, it's a nicer anastomosis. You're not trying to make the small colon and the big rectum, meet. Rather, the side limb, I feel, just sits nicer. And so people have looked at it, and it's equivalent to the colonic J pouch in terms of function. And all these restorative techniques, as much as we would love them to change outcome, they essentially probably impact stool frequency in the first 18 months, and then it plateaus and everybody's the same as a straight to end. But you know what? That's the part that really impacts patients' lives when it's all new. And so I've had some people with Baker anastomosis that have 2 or 3 regular bowel movements with very minimal clustering. I've had some that, you know, you wouldn't tell that I did a restorative technique because they're still having terrible symptoms. But I always try to do a side-to-end Baker anastomosis if feasible.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, I think that and avoiding a leak, but we all try to avoid a leak. So what are we going to do?
Yeah. it's such a bane of our existence. Oh my gosh. So there's so many, honestly, we could talk about this for hours. I do want to highlight some of the work that you've done looking at the actual impact of LARS on patients' lives. And, you know, in particular, you know, you and Jenny Moon just recently had a paper come out about mental health issues for patients who have LARS. There was a great paper that you and Richard Garfinkel put out about financial toxicity. Can you talk a little bit about the impact that LARS has on these patients, not just from a physiologic perspective, but globally within their lives?
Yes, absolutely. The financial impact one really stemmed from what I was seeing in clinic is patients weren't able to go back to their same jobs or to work at all. So I had many patients who would kind of prolong their sick leave and take early retirement, and others that had to change their shift or change their job. And so what Richard and I did is we looked at the financial stress and strain as another patient reported outcome measure. And we looked at it in our rectal cancer patients, about 150 patients, if I remember correctly. And we looked at, you know, who had major LARS and the association of major LARS with financial stress and strain. Of course, there's recall bias because we asked them, you know, a couple of years out from their surgery. But 50% of patients who had major LARS reported significant financial stress and strain, which was remarkable. And when we delved into it, it was that they had to delay their return to work, take early retirement, change their job, or change the time of their job. And, you know, when I presented this to my colleagues at research meeting, they're like, no, there's got to be something wrong here. That's like, that's not really happening. And it's true. Like half of our patients, half of our patients will have very bad LARS. Half of those will have a very significant financial impact because they're not able to return to their occupation as it is. And so, and that's, you know, in Montreal. And so it is definitely pervasive. And that led to the work that I did with Jenny. Jenny was really passionate as like when she entered her research time, that she really wanted to make patients better. And she was really passionate about LARS in a patient-centric way. And so we looked at the impact, knowing this, the work that Richard had done, we said, let's look at the impact on mental health. And so we used a UK database, which is pretty cool. It's a primary care database that records a lot of symptoms and lifestyle factors. And it's a longitudinal data set. And Richard used it too in his master's. And it was super neat in that you can follow patients out. So we followed 2000 proctectomy patients for 5 years. And 1/3 of patients had de novo mental health disorder defined as a visit to a psychiatrist or a psychotropic medication, like an antidepressant or, all the psychotropic medications be prescribed. And it's 1/3 of our rectal cancer patients. Those are the UK patients. I'm sure ours in Canada are not any different in their long-term survivorship. And we found that that was significantly associated with bowel dysfunction, not surprising. So it definitely has a pervasive effect. And we're not screening for mental health in our clinics, but you know, we see it in their faces. We see it like we're like, you know, you should be good now, you're cancer free. You know, but it's pervasive. They go through a lot. You know, they go through a year of treatment, our patients, if everything goes smoothly, to become rectal cancer free. And so I think it has an overall big impact on their lives. And the younger patients are, I think, the greater the trauma to them, their children, their wives. I've seen, we had a really good psychology team for our young rectal cancer patients at the Jewish. And they go through a really rough period. I think you can all imagine, we can all imagine what it would be like. So,
yeah, having a stoma, you know, there's so many aspects to that. Dr. Butch, this is an amazing chat and really like a crash course in LARS. And if no one else has learned anything, I've learned so much that I'll immediately apply to my practice. But, you know, I have to be selfish again and ask you, you've gone on and done some amazing research in the time that you've been a staff. It's really like amazing to look at all the different things that you've done. What advice do you have for people starting out who are interested in doing research? How do you go about building a research program the way you've done? What do you think are some of the like key tips or tricks and advice that you give to people who are starting out who want to build a research program like you have?
First of all, this is the best pep talk I'll get this year. So thank you. I would say believe in yourself and focus as early as you can. So when I came back to the Jewish in 2012, the CEO was at the time was a surgeon and he really wanted to help me out. And he was like, so Mary Lee's like, what's your elevator pitch? Like, what are you trying to solve? And I was like, I want to do colorectal surgery research and make the world better. And I had zero pitch, zero focus. And only when I just dabbled in everything and, you know, I was having fun doing it all. But when you focus, you say like, and it doesn't matter if you change your focus, you say, you know, diverticulitis, I see a lot of it. It's all mixed up. I want to make it better. Whatever it be, focus early and identify a problem that you think you want to work on. Doesn't matter. You're not married to it all your life. But when you focus, then your clinical work, your research work, your grants can build up. And I honestly only did that 5 years into practice. The first 5 years were all dabbling. And you lose speed there. And so that would be my best is if you can't give an elevator pitch to the CEO, you're not going to move forward. You won't get funders. You won't get money. You won't get people saying, you know, hey, this Mary Lee's person, she's interested in LARS. That so people know that. So they can invite you to do that. You can join collaborations to do that. But otherwise, you're just this person doing a lot of stuff is what I was doing for the first 5 years. I think work with good people. It's all about the team. A lot of what I've done, I had no idea how to do. And till now, I lean on a great team, whether it be the trainees who did all the work. I just get to orchestrate it. And then I have like a grant team who help me. And so you really got to get a grant put together early and don't be afraid to put, you know, pen on paper or, you know, type it out. And then you give it to people who are going to tear it apart. And usually they're non-surgeons. So those are my favorite people. And I like, we made verbs with their last names because they really like, they kill it. And you know that they're going to bring your grant to the greater level and you got to give them time to do it. So I think that grant team is really, really helpful. And then you need money. And so I was very fortunate that Carol Ann Vasilevsky, she really saw what I wanted to do from the beginning and funded this program with philanthropy and department funds. And I didn't have to raise those funds myself at first, but then the funds bring themselves because patients see what you're trying to do and they donate and contribute to the funds. But you need some money because eventually you want a full-time employee to help you do all of this stuff. And, you know, so I think those are the main things, but focus early, get your elevator pitch early. Yeah.
Part two of the podcast with Dr. Boutros is going to be how to write your elevator pitch, get money, become the most productive you. That is such great advice. I just want to also just mention that you are also the president of the organizer for the Next Sages meeting. You're involved in all these different societies. You have a young family. So I just wanted to say that, you know, you're involved in all these different societies. You have a family. How do you juggle all these different elements in your life?
Oh, well, I have a great partner and it's, I don't know that I have a good recipe. I think having your priorities. So my husband, before I take on any bigger role, I'll say, hey, you know, I was offered to do this. And he said, well, will it make you happy? I said, yeah, I like it. And then he'd say, well, what will it take the place of? How are you going to manage? And so he's the voice of reason. He's also the one taking care of the kids when I'm not there. I think so. I pick and choose. You got to pick and choose what you want to do and how it fits into the bigger frame of your focus. But a lot of these things make us really happy. Like we love taking care of patients, but society work makes us part of a greater community. I learn a lot. I make a lot of, it's kind of like my social surgical circle. So you learn from a lot of people. You get to do really cool collaborations. And so I prioritize that work because I think it's fun. Trainees and mentorship, I think, make us really happy. And at the end of the day, I think it's where I feel the most fulfilled that, you know, you see the younger generation doing better than ourselves and doing great things. And so something's got to go. And so my social circle is really my friends' kids and what they want to do. And a lot of my good friends from the past, I keep in touch with very seldomly and they like me for who I am, I guess. And so something has to give, right? And so the kids and the family are the priority and I compartmentalize. So the weekend is really theirs. I try to schedule nothing on the weekend unless it's like I'm on call. And even then I'm in and out and I do what I got to do. And if I travel, then I try to accommodate during the week that I do a drop off or a pickup so that I'm there. You know, during the week, I try to be home a little bit in the evenings to see them before they sleep and then get back on Zoom or whatever it is we're doing after the kids are asleep. And so I think having compartments and a schedule that you follow really helps and a partner who's understanding and doing the heavy lifting for sure. And then picking things that you like to do so you could be happy. And when you're happy at work, you're happy at home and you're able to sleep a little less or work a little harder, I guess. But I don't know that I'm a good example.
That is such sage advice. Dr. Boutros, we always end by asking our guests as sort of our closer question, which is if you could go back in time to when you were a chief resident or perhaps an early attending, what advice would you give yourself knowing what you know now?
I think really believe in yourself and know your value. I always felt like there's so many great people. I'm just like, you know, I don't know why these people believe in me. And I still think that sometimes, but whether you're in surgery or in clinic, people or in research, people can sense how much you believe in yourself, I guess. And they'll believe in you more if you believe in yourself. So I'd say trust yourself, believe in yourself, introspect and see what your goals are and just believe them and do them. So yeah, that's what I tell myself. Be a little bit more self-believing and not wait for outside, you know, telling you that you're doing the right thing.
You've been listening to Cold Steel, the official podcast of the Canadian Journal of Surgery. This episode was produced and edited by Kirsten Allen, one of our new team members on the Cold Steel team and a medical student at Queen's University. If you have comments or questions, please email us at podcast.cjs@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.